Welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen. And today I'm excited to bring a book that I think is apropos for sort of the times that we're living in, or at least this very current news cycle. And I'd like to welcome on Dr. John Hale, Assistant Professor of Educational History, Department of Teacher Education, College of Charleston. And we're going to be talking about his very recent book, especially in sort of the publishing world, The Freedom Schools, Student Activist in Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. And this is from Columbia University Press, published just now in 2016. Dr. Hale, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for the invitation.
If you could, maybe just get us started. What's your background? How do you get involved in educational history and then maybe even civil rights history or things like that as well?
Yeah, so I was completing a teacher education program in Wisconsin, and I was teaching high school. And at the time, I was very interested in the historian and activist Howard Zinn, and I was sort of reading everything I could get my hands on. And this led me to an article that he published in The Nation in the fall of 1964. It was called The Freedom Schools in Context. And I was very much interested in looking at history from the bottom up, but also how we could use schools as a way to reform systemic inequality. And when I read this article by Zinn, it introduced me to the idea of the freedom schools. And it was sort of a model that I became interested in immediately. And when I decided to go to graduate school, within the next couple of years, I was looking at the freedom schools as something to study. And I noticed that no one, or there was not significant attention paid to the freedom schools by scholars and historians, and also educators who were in the field. So I took this up as a field of study, but then also as a model to consider when we're looking at educational reform. So I had this idea when I started graduate school at the University of Illinois and really just kept with it. So the book is a product of this inquiry. It really goes back, 10, 12 years.
Yeah, fantastic. I think that's great when we can find something that maybe hasn't been touched upon that much and then really expand it, make it your own, and you know, become the expert that you have, and give us this book and get more people interested in this kind of maybe missing history or history that we don't quite understand yet. So if we could, then what are these freedom schools? What exactly, or can you give us a little background on what that is? And then maybe as well, set us up with Mississippi education, Jim Crow, if you kind of like root us in where you sort of began with the book.
Yeah, so just a little bit of context to start is, you know, the term freedom schooler goes back to Reconstruction. We see the term freedom schools throughout there, and this since Reconstruction in the 1860s, and it's sort of grounded in the notion of freedmen schools, or the first schools that originated during the period of Reconstruction. And freed slaves made a direct connection between education and freedom because it was denied during slavery. So upon emancipation, one of the first acts that not only black Reconstruction politicians, but also local grassroots organizers, they established schools, and they sort of took on the name freedmen's schools or freedom schools because of what education meant to the freed slave community. So the idea of the schools I trace back in the book to Reconstruction. This freedom schools themselves in Mississippi was a network of 41 schools, I estimate about 41 schools, that really are traced to 1964. So the freedom schools that I look at specifically in the book are schools started by activists who were interested in reaching young people to train them to become leaders in the local civil rights movement, and also to prevent talented young African-American youth from leaving the state, because there's sort of a brain drain and migration still occurring. So it was an attempt to train local youth in the local movement, and also to sort of inspire people to stay in the state too, and to take on the movement. But the freedom schools, not only a network of schools that conjure up ideas of education for freedom and education for liberation, the freedom schools stood in stark contrast to what to the education that the state of Mississippi was providing. So in 1964, schools were still segregated. It wasn't until the fall after the freedom schools started that schools were desegregated. And even then, there was only a handful of students at desegregated schools. And of course, as you can imagine, with a segregated school system, Black schools were underfunded, under-resourced. They were, you know, found to be inferior by the courts up to the Supreme Court level, of course. So they provided a new type of education, and it was education for activism. It was a really prominent moment in American history where we have this sort of model of education where we're directly training young people, you know, as early as the elementary grades to become active in the civil rights movement. So what I try to do with the book is to give that history of the specific schools that start in 64, but place this in the long context of the Black freedom struggle and grassroots organizers regularly using education as a way to advance the movement.
And so most of these activists, they come from the Freedom Riders, or was it a larger activist who were there, kind of both, or how did that work?
Yes, so the Freedom Schools themselves were part of the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project, which was a massive voter registration campaign that begins during the summer of 1964 called Freedom Summer. Mm-hmm. And there was about, we estimate, you know, the numbers about, they give, you know, between 1,000 and 1,200 activists formally joined Freedom Summer. But I found in my research that there are hundreds of other volunteers who just sort of come to Mississippi unannounced and show up and work for a little bit for a couple of days and go home. So I estimate it's closer to 2,000 activists that were really in Mississippi that summer. And it's these activists who start the Freedom Schools and teach in the Freedom Schools. So it's part of this larger Freedom Summer campaign, and they are the teachers. Mm-hmm. But after the activists go home, after the summer's over, we see the local teachers sort of take over the schools in some way after the activists go home. So those are the activists. But the students themselves often had a longer history of activism. They were active, as they talk about in the book, they were active in their local communities before attending freedom schools. So attending freedom school is actually just an extension of their local activism.
So what, if we could maybe continue along that that path, can we kind of talk about sort of what the organization is? If this is separate from the normal schools, maybe you mentioned that there were teachers still involved. Did they go and set this up in churches, other communities? How did that work?
Yeah, so it was a challenge to find space for freedom schools because most of the volunteers that were coming to Mississippi during the summer of 1964 were white. And, you know, they literally stuck out in local Mississippi communities, just how they dressed, how they talked. The cars, right, had out-of-state license plates, so they were tagged from the start. And the Mississippi power structure wanted nothing to do with the activists and, in fact, regularly targeted them and through law enforcement, arresting them, you know, providing tickets for any given reason. So they were targeted. In other words, that they weren't allowed into the public schools that existed. So they were forced to look for space outside of the traditional public spaces that were regularly available. So this meant that freedom schools occurred anywhere from churches and church basements. People opened their homes and freedom school could be held at homes. There are numerous freedom schools that were held outside. In Meridian, we have a case where it's held in an old Baptist seminary. So churches supplied a lot of the space for the freedom schools, but also local Black community members all opened up their homes as well. So they were truly alternative in every sense of the word, not only in the ideology they put forth or the pedagogy that they employed, but also the physical space where they met. So it was outside of public schools in very unorthodox spaces.
Yeah. Well, I guess if we can go into following your last point, talking about the pedagogy, talking about the curriculum, where did that come from? The students themselves were able to have input into what they were sort of learning and doing, or where did that come from, and how was it different maybe than what they were sort of normally doing?
So it's interesting because there was a Freedom School curriculum conference held in New York in March, you know, just 3 months, excuse me, 3 months before the summer program actually starts. And here we have activists such as Miles Horton, who is a radical white educator from Tennessee. He's the founder of the Highlander Folk School. Ella Baker contributes to this. They draw upon the work of Septema Clark, who's an activist in South Carolina. And they sort of sit down and outline the curriculum. And the first part of the curriculum is sort of shaped by what activists think young leaders need to know. So they're drawing upon Black history, teaching the longer history of the civil rights movement. They're teaching about resistance during the era of slavery. They're, of course, drawing upon Black culture and literature. So they're assigning writers from the Harlem Renaissance, for instance, who's very much immersed in Black history and culture. But there's also an aspect of the curriculum that focuses on leadership development. So here, where Freedom School students are learning how to participate in nonviolent direct action protests, how to take the kicks and assaults of white supremacists during protests. They're learning how to organize, how to canvass. They're handing out voter registration primers that they use to register voters during this time period. So it's content in the movement, but it's also leadership skills. At the same time, the curriculum is intentionally left open to meet the interests and needs of the students. So when students go to school, if they want to learn a particular subject, Freedom School students are going to accommodate their teaching to meet the interests of the students. So for instance, we have numerous cases throughout the Freedom Schools where Black students are coming to teachers and asking to learn subjects such as French, because French is associated with white education and college access, and a lot of students don't have these classes in their regular schools. So they come to Freedom School and they say, we'd like to learn French. So Freedom School teachers sort of scramble to meet that interest and find someone who can speak and teach French. So it's prescribed by activists, but there's also this element that's left open for the Freedom School students to determine themselves.
So if we could maybe talk a little, we talked about the teachers, but maybe who are these students? Who are the ones coming to the school? Are they, you mentioned they're already sort of potentially activist in their communities. But can we just talk about those students? And you actually talked to, I think you said like 10 or so former students. So can you maybe also talk about just what it was like actually meeting them or talking with them?
Yes. What I wanted to do with the Freedom Schools, with my book project, was to actually ground the history in the from the perspective and vantage point of the students. Mm-hmm. Because what I noticed within the historiography was that not only were historians and scholars overlooking the Freedom Schools and the impact it had on the movement, but when the story of Freedom Summer and Freedom Schools were reconstructed within the literature, it was almost always or almost exclusively from the viewpoint of the activists themselves. And that's a different viewpoint from what the students are bringing to the literature. So I intentionally grounded my book from the perspective of the students. So the first couple chapters follow a handful of students and how they arrived at the front doors of the Freedom Schools. So to do this, I mean, you have Freedom School poems in the archives, for instance. You have the curriculum in the archives, but that really doesn't give you the whole voice. So what I did was I tracked down, to the best of my ability, as many Freedom School students as I could find, and I made contact with and interviewed, 20, 25 students. But then with the book, students that I established a close working relationship with, I prioritized their stories and those who really took the time to teach me this history. So I prioritized certain students within the book. And so, for instance, the young man on the cover of the book is Eddie James Carthen. He lives in Chula, Mississippi, in the Delta, to this day. And Freedom School students like Mr. Carthen, Himethia Lofton Washington, who I interviewed, Brenda Travis records are available. You know, these students, what I found almost across the state of Mississippi is the students who were attending Freedom Schools were already active in the movement. So some of the parents of the Freedom School students were involved in NAACP. Some were involved in registering voters before Freedom Summer began, some students were already arrested. Hezekiah Watkins was a student in Jackson. He was arrested during the Freedom Rise in 1961. So these students were already activated. You know, the Freedom Schools didn't necessarily introduce students to the movement like activists thought. So following the students, you see that they were already active, and this was an extension of their activism. And this actually creates a dynamic within the classroom where many times the students are the ones actually teaching the teachers about the movement or what it meant to be Black in Mississippi or what the movement meant to local Mississippians. So the students, again, very active in the movement, and this was just sort of sharpening the skills that they already were learning by as participants in the ongoing movement.
Sure.
Sure.
Did you get a sense when you were talking to students that the Freedom School experience was something that they still carried on, or that it had a lasting impact on the person that shaped them, or was it within a totality of this whole era that shaped them as well?
It was partly, you know, it was the whole movement itself that sort of shaped the rest of their lives, and it's also, you know, they're a little too young to remember Emmett Till, but they grew up hearing stories about Emmett Till, and that shaped the rest of their lives as well. But everyone I interviewed and spoke with and visited the sites of the schools with the students who participated, the Freedom Schools themselves very much had a lasting impact on them, because not only were they becoming more involved through the Freedom Schools and joining the front lines of the civil rights movement and oftentimes arrested and assaulted, but which itself is a memory that, you know, they carry with them to this day. But the Freedom Schools, you know, this created close personal contact with sympathetic white activists. And typically growing up Black in Mississippi, these students, if they came into contact with white people, these were hostile white folks who never treated them as equals or never took the time to genuinely engage them on a personal level. So this was the first time that many Black students interacted with, again, sympathetic white activists and teachers. And that itself, I found, was a very profound moment in the lives of these young people. And that moment of integration, that true integration of interacting equally with someone from a different race, truly had a strong, profound impact on the rest of their lives. And they all recount the Freedom Schools as a moment in their life where they truly became active, and many of them, if not all of the people I interviewed, are still active in one way or another to this day.
So what then, if this was sort of an important point within Mississippi education, civil rights movement, what sort of happened to the Freedom Schools, and maybe even did they still have a direct legacy with education, or maybe civil rights movement, social movements there today?
Yeah, so what happened? Again, you know, the Freedom School ideology remains consistent throughout the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement. Again, we trace this to Reconstruction. But the Freedom Schools themselves, the network of schools that originated in 1964, it sort of ends and dissipates by the end of the summer of 1965. And as I look at toward the end of my book is the Head Start program and the war on poverty really sort of in some ways appropriates what happens in Mississippi, because the federal government is investing in Head Start education programs, and these are essentially grassroots programs. And a lot of the students and teachers and parents involved begin to work with Head Start. So there's sort of a transition between Freedom Schools and Head Start, and this sort of takes away some of the energy that was behind the Freedom Schools. Also, of course, when these 1,500-plus activists leave the state of Mississippi, this naturally takes away from the teaching force that, you know, occupy the classrooms of the Freedom Schools. When the teachers leave, many of the schools shut down. But, you know, having said that, the Freedom School ideology persists. And we see this when the Freedom School students go back to their public schools. They conduct boycotts, student walkouts. There's numerous instances of walkouts throughout the state of Mississippi. And when these walkouts occur and they leave the public schools in protest, they actually form freedom schools to maintain a level of education, and they call them freedom schools in honor of the schools that they just attended. So, you know, it carries on in some forms, but then also it transforms or morphs into a different sort of program, which we see in Head Start and other war and poverty programs. And then today, to answer your question about the direct legacy, Marion Wright Edelman and the Children's Defense Fund have a very extensive freedom school program which exists across the country. So this is a direct legacy of the program, and we see many of the ideas that were implemented in 1964, we see in the freedom school curriculum today.
Sure. So I guess we're kind of coming to the end of the podcast, and if I could, maybe if you could just one takeaway that you would like us to get from the book. And if we also ask sort of the final question also on the podcast is, you know, what are you working on next? What project comes after this one?
So one takeaway from the book I think I would like everyone to consider is that education in many ways was the foundation and backbone of the civil rights movement. And I'm not speaking in terms of the Brown decision. I'm talking about how activists and young people used education as a way to advance and further the civil rights movement. People were educating themselves on how to join the front lines of the movement, and they're also educating themselves about what the movement itself was. So the education is absolutely crucial to expanding the movement. And also, another takeaway from the book is just to look at how young activists were. We typically associate civil rights activists with college-age students and, you know, those ministers and pastors who were outspoken. But when you look at the age of young people in the movement, I mean, these were 10, 11, 12 through 16 years old. They were on the front lines of the movement. In many ways, they implemented protests that sort of galvanized the local movement. It was young people who were at the front lines, and I don't think we really give enough credit to young people. So to really see that young people were central change agents in the movement, and that today still, you know, young people hold the capacity and the potential to truly implement a movement or to maintain the movement that we're observing today. In terms of the project I'm working on now, I've received a fellowship for this past year, and I'm starting research and beginning to write a new book on the history of Black high schools and their role in the Southern freedom movement. So as I was researching the freedom schools, I noticed, again, how young activists were, and I really thought that there was a gap in historiography that weren't addressing young people, and especially high schools. So high schools themselves, I'm finding, were incubators of the civil rights movement, and high schools were also sites of political ideology that really shaped the movement. And we're just not giving them enough credit. So my new project is sort of unearthing the material around youth, the politics around youth, and the role of the high school.
Yeah, I mean, so I love the message that you end with the book, and I think the time that we're living in right now, and the past, you know, year and a half, 2 years, we can take away a lot from that. So hopefully, everyone out there, you know, if you're not a student yourself, if you have students, get them to check this out and to pass on this history. And then also the next project sounds great. Maybe when you're done, we can have you back on if that's going to be in a book form. But I just want to say thank you, Dr. Hale, and I want everyone to go check out The Freedom Schools, Student Activists in the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. And to everyone out there, I hope you learned something.